Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, 20 years after they were first sighted off the coast of Cork, the same humpback whales are spotted again in Irish waters. We hear about RHD2. It's not a robot, it's a deadly disease spreading amongst our wild rabbit population. And Terry Flanagan is once again standing on the shoulder of a giant as he discovers more about the black-headed gull.
We went out and we ringed 300 chicks of black-headed gulls on Lough Ree. So these birds all hatched on Lough Ree this summer in June, took a couple of weeks to fledge, and then it's kind of where do they go after that. So we know from other ringing projects that suggest, you know, they might move further south, maybe over to the west coast, to Galway or to somewhere like Limerick. Actually, the first two birds that have been seen from our project have been on a beach in County Meath, and I happened to see one on Bull Island 2 weeks ago in Dublin.
Yes, a very good evening to you and a very busy programme and a very busy studio we have too. Richard Collins is here with me, Éanan Ní Lana and Ferdy Murnell, who's head of animal ecology with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Ferdy, it's a long time since we've seen you. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. And you're going to talk about something very serious, RHD2. What does it stand for?
It stands for rabbit hemorrhagic disease number 2.
No, well, that's fairly straightforward. Do you know what you're talking about?
Have we had a number one already?
We did, yeah. Number one appeared in the 1980s, and this is a new variation of it. So it's a nasty virus, and it's and our particular concern is that it's spilling over into hares.
So, well, tell us more. How did it get in here? When was it noticed? Who noticed it? And what are the consequences of it?
So we first were informed about it in the wild. It's been in domestic pets in Ireland for a number of years, maybe 3 years, something like that. We got the first record in the wild at the end of July this year, and that was in a rabbit in Wicklow, and then very rapidly got a report from another one of our rangers of a rabbit in Clare that had the same disease. So the situation in Clare was out in Scattery Island, which is a public, it's an OPW site, so it's a historic property, and our ranger was out there doing regular monitoring, and she saw that there were many dead rabbits lying around. Now, I suppose to some extent we're sort of used to that in Ireland because they have regular diseases, whether it's myxomatosis or whatever, and this original RHD1 would have been here maybe for many years before that. But she thought this looked unusual, and she had the presence of mind to take one of the animals that she saw dying in front of her, and we got it tested by the Department of Agriculture.
Now, when she said she thought it looked unusual, in what way?
So the animal died as she watched it, and it was convulsing and fitting and then keeled over and died. And as I say, there were several other rabbits around that had clearly died in the recent past.
Was it bleeding as well? Because it's a hemorrhagic thing.
It wasn't. That particular one wasn't. Although some of the other specimens we've had since
do.
Yeah, it's an internal. So as the name suggests, it's internal hemorrhaging is what causes the death. So the internal organs fail, and sometimes that leads to external bleeding from the eyes and from the nose. But it wasn't until we had the test done by the Department of Agriculture and their virology labs in Back Weston in particular that we discovered that this was RHD2, and it was the first time we'd had it in Ireland.
And had it been anywhere else? Had it been in the UK? Had it been in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, we sort of knew it was on the horizon, I suppose. It appeared in France in about 2010. And that was the first time it had been discovered. So this is so viruses, as you know, they are very good at replicating very
absolutely
rapidly.
And very hard to keep out.
And they're very good at mutating. Mm. And a lot of the mutations fail, but occasionally a mutation is effective and can then replicate. And what this mutation effectively has done is it's given it a broader host range to work with. So instead of just being effective in rabbits, this disease is able to spill into hares. And we had heard that a number of species on the continent had already been affected. Then the brown hare in the UK was showing signs of this a few years ago. And then we have this first case in a mountain hare in Ireland, an Irish endemic Irish hare from August of this year.
Was it in rabbits in France when it was first discovered?
Yes.
So is that where it started, in a rabbit?
Yeah. Yes, that's the feeling. And the very original RHD1, or RHD as it was called, was actually first discovered in domestic rabbits. So in fact, it turned up in China. Within a year, it had killed over 100 million rabbits in the farmed industry over there, which is enormous, and had spilled from there into various other places, and then has come into the pet trade as well. So we think one of the possible routes into the UK, for example, was in the pet trade. So apparently there's a lot of show rabbits that are moved between the continent and the UK. I've learned a lot about rabbits in the last couple of months. So a lot of the shows were closed. There is a shooting of brown hares. years in the UK, a lot of the estates that do that have voluntarily closed their chutes to try and contain the problem. We're a little bit, are playing catch up here.
Well, why would they close their chutes? Who's spreading it? I mean, is it spreading from animal to animal, or are we spreading it?
So one of the problems is we know really very little about this. A lot of the work that's been done has been done on laboratory rabbits, which has very little transferability to wild rabbits, never mind wild hares. So we have been in discussions with the University of East Anglia. Professor Diana Bell over there has done a lot of the research. And she has, I think, about 200 hares now in storage waiting to be tested, because they don't have the testing facilities over there that we have here. We're very lucky that the Department of Agriculture actually had a virology lab that was able to run these tests very quickly for us. So we're actually, we're sort of ahead of the curve now, having been sort of playing catch up. So it's very widespread in the UK, but they haven't actually tested a huge number of animals to find out, is it the only thing that's causing these mortality events? So in some parts of the UK, brown rabbits, or brown hares rather, have declined by 70%. And it's clearly RHD2 has a role in that, but it may be mixed in with myxomatosis, or it could be other things. There's also a European brown hare syndrome which causes the disease. The real problem that we're discovering is that it's very transferable. It can survive on in a carcass for up to 2 months in the wild. It can survive on the droppings of an infected animal.
So you think any animal potentially could pick up this virus?
If you
come along, you're a badger out at night and you're sniffing around for food and you sniff this dead rabbit and it's got the virus, and you say that the virus is lingering for about 2 months in the carcass, is it possible that the badger then can pick
it
up?
It's possible that predators can pick it up and transfer it. They won't be impacted by it, so it doesn't impact dogs.
Why not?
It's because it's a very specific virus. Now, it's not as specific as RHD1.
But as you say yourself, virus can mutate.
It's possible that a further version of it in due course may emerge, RHD3.
Yeah.
Let's hope not. But at the moment, what we have is RHD2, and it's only, as far as we know, it's only proven in rabbits and hares. Now, there's some concern also about shrews, which we might come back to, but that's unproven.
We'll do that in a second. But can I ask, for the benefit of the listener, and indeed myself as a listener, RHD and then RHD2, what is the difference? I mean, when you're looking at this through a microscope, what are you seeing that makes one and the other one number two, if you know what I mean?
Well, I'm not a virologist, but my understanding is that it is a mutation. So you effectively have a strip of DNA, which, as you know, we all have DNA in us. And as you recombine that, it allows for mutations to happen. Sometimes those mutations lead to new species over a long period of time. But viruses replicate so rapidly that they can produce new variations very, very quickly.
Yeah, maybe so, I can come in on that.
Okay,
actually did a degree in microbiology.
Well, then you're very welcome to the programme, eh?
Thank you very much indeed. But viruses are actually a most peculiar thing, because they're not actually a cell at all. They're actually only the DNA. They're only the reproductive part of a cell. So when they get into the cell of a host, they actually start taking over, making the DNA in their own image. So therefore, obviously, if they get into a rabbit or into a hare, the rabbit and hare cells, they're actually organised so that they can snip into that. So if they get into a badger or into you or into me, our chromosomes, our DNA is different to those of rabbits and hares. So if you happen to pick up this particular virus and it got into your cell, it would just say, what am I doing here? I don't know anybody here. And it wouldn't do anything in the form that it's in now. So that's why we needn't be afraid of it as it exists. Then, of course, it'll mutate, and that's a different story. But as it is in the form of RH1 or 2, it won't get into our cells and recognise itself at home and start taking over the shop. Because that's what the flu viruses do, and that's why, you know, it's so fatal for people who are compromised, because when the flu viruses that affect humans get into our cells, they're viruses as well, and they start taking over.
Yeah, but
so
every
it's
year
a different mechanism to bacteria.
Every year, all of the pharmacologists or chemists or whoever it is, the flu people, sit around and they kind of predict what flu virus is going to be out there, and we get a shot in the arm to help us fight our way through the flu and not get. So can you do that with the rabbits? I mean, but you've mentioned several times there the hare, and it leads me to think that perhaps you're more concerned about the hare than you are about the rabbits.
Well, to be blunt, we are. And the reason for that is that the hare is for a number of reasons, but I suppose the hare is a protected species, whereas the rabbit is not. And the hare is endemic to Ireland, whereas the rabbit is found all over Europe. So we have a particular role within the National Parks and Wildlife Service to conserve the hare. So it's an iconic species.
So he's our hare. He's not the same as the hare in Britain. He's not the same as the hare on the continent.
No, it's
he's
a been here. Species, isn't
he's
it?
Been here yeah. since the Ice yeah. Age, since yes. before yeah. the Ice Age, yeah. in fact. Exactly. So he's our one. And you were saying about why would they stop shooting and hunting them? Because obviously, if the population is compromised by a disease, and you're supposed to be a sportsman, would you be out shooting hares that are half paralysed and sick anyway? That's not sport. So not that anything is sport.
Well, that was also to stop the spread of the disease.
Well, it is,
as well. That was the purpose for that. That's why I asked.
And it can be spread on soil and on bags and nets. and car wheels. So we're, you know.
And of course, the bottom line is that you're stopping coursing happening this year in February because you're not allowing the game clubs to net hares to have them for the coursing. Isn't that what the application of it is here in Ireland?
Well, that's one of the, yes, that's one of the measures that the minister has put in place, that she's withdrawn the coursing licence for this year. And that's, I suppose, that's an evolving situation. I'm not sure how it will evolve, but I suppose in the meantime we're constantly monitoring what's going on in terms of, we have rangers out looking in all areas to see can they find further evidence of this, and to date we have evidence of it in 8 counties. Most of the cases we have to date are in rabbits, but we have hares from Wexford and now from North Dublin, both positive with the disease as well. So whether this is it actually actively spreading or whether we're just catching up and it's actually been here for a long time or a number of years, we're still trying to find that.
And Wexford is a good place for hares, is it not? Particularly the Wexford slobs.
Yeah, and that's where the first record.
Oh, was it? And
up, yeah.
Dublin Airport, you see plenty of hares around there, the Bull Island and places like that.
I mean, one of the interesting things we've seen, including Scattery
Island,
Bull Island.
Not the Bull Island, sorry.
They're all gone off Bull Island, they're gone there. Thanks to the dogs.
But Dublin Airport.
Oh, Dublin Airport is crawling with them, yeah.
One of the things that we've seen, for example, in Scattery Island, is that there are some animals survive, so there are still lots of rabbits running around on Scattery Island. So whether this is to do with some sort of gradual immunity or something else that's happening, we don't know yet.
Because I mean, if a virus kills all the hosts, then that's not much good for the virus because it's going to go too. So like, I mean, it doesn't make sense if you're a virus to absolutely wipe out whatever it is that's causing you to reproduce. So the virulence of them does tend to abate as time goes on.
Yes,
the animals then will become resistant to this and they can live in harmony.
We're just not sure where we are in that curve.
But we don't know how far on we are with that. But it's not a good scene if you're a rabbit or a hare in Ireland, is it?
Yeah.
Poor old rabbits. We've despised rabbits in this country. They're not kind of legitimate members of the wildlife community, brought by the Romans to the north of Europe and by the Normans onto Ireland and all this kind of thing. We shouldn't really have them sort of stuff. But the interesting thing about rabbits now is that they are part of the environment in a unique kind of way. Lots of things depend on them. You know, lots of things eat them, foxes and stoats and birds of prey, buzzards and all kinds of things love to eat rabbits. So if the poor old rabbits are wiped out, then it will have consequences for other things. It is not, they do have a role to play. We should accept them as honorary members of our wildlife community. The other thing I want to ask is the poor old Chinese. They're playing for all viruses begin in China, whether it's chickens and birds or the flu or the common cold. The viruses over in China are all over the place and they're always trying on new combinations on their surface until they fit in and then they spread like wildfire. And we have it down on China, you know. Is there any real basis for all of this? Did this thing begin in China as well? I'm sure they're going to say it did, whether it did or not. But there's a few questions there for you to deal with.
There were. I'm trying to remember. I'll take the last one first. I don't think this did emerge in China. I think it was first discovered in China. So perhaps it's a compliment to the Chinese virologists that they're actually on the ball and they're spotting these things. I think there's some more recent suggestions that it might have arrived in China from Germany, but let's not spread the blame too far and wide. Your earlier points about the... Oh, you bring it in. It has been brought into...
Yeah.
It's been brought into Australia. Specifically, this particular one, specifically for that issue. Yeah, and they brought it in as trials to try it on offshore islands, and before they knew it, it had spread to the mainland, and it's caused widespread devastation of the rabbit
population in Australia. And no doubt widespread celebration too among certain quarters, isn't
that true? I don't know about that. I mean, to come back to Ireland, I mean, even though the rabbit is not a protected species, it's a very important part of the ecosystem here, and so many predators rely on it for food, and not just the mammals, but if you think of things like the golden eagles and the white-tailed eagles and the buzzards and those
the burgeoning
numbers of birds of prey that we have in Ireland now, we would be concerned about the impact it might have on them.
But mind you, they've introduced the rabbit to Australia totally against all of the ecosystems there and caused all kinds of ecological problems. So I suppose they are within their rights to try and get rid of those and rats and possums and all the things that are upsetting the native marsupial mammals that they have there. I mean, they're not amicable with the rabbits anyway.
Yeah, I think what they'd hoped to do was do it in a controlled way. But what they found was that the suggestion is that even though it was on an offshore island and they were very careful about their biosecurity, that the virus may have been spread through insects. So a biting insect would have picked it up on the island and just flown back to the mainland and off it went.
Now, Dr. Marnell, have you a prescription? We've discussed the problem and all the rest of it and what's going on. Now, at the end, we're going out the door. You're a very busy consultant, a very busy GP in the wildlife world. So will you write a prescription for us, telling us what we should do and what we should not do? Is there any guidance that we can adopt about this?
Yeah, so we're getting a lot of queries about pet rabbits. So the National Parks and Wildlife Service don't have any role or responsibility for pet rabbits, but your local vet knows all about your pet rabbit, and there is a vaccine available for pet rabbits for this disease, for this specific version of RHD2. So anyone who's worried about their pet rabbits should talk to their vet and they'll sort them out. In terms of what we can do, what we're encouraging people to do are to keep an eye out, particularly for hares at this stage. I mean, the impression we have, and I don't want to demean the rabbit again, but the impression we have is that this is fairly widespread in rabbits right across the country. So as I say, we have records in 8 counties, you know, from Leitrim to Cork and Wexford to Clare. So it's, you know, it's pretty widespread. We're less sure about how widespread it is in hares. We don't know whether is it a real host? Is it just a spillover host? So a couple of the animals that have been tested for us in Back West and by the Department of Agriculture have shown very high viral loads.
These are the hares.
Would suggest that it's very happy in hares. You know, it's not an accidental spillover. It's just whenever it can find a hare, it will infect a hare. But we don't have very many records of those, and obviously we'd like to get a full handle on how widespread it is and the impact it's going to have
on
us.
So do you want people to send you in pictures, photographs of dead hares?
Yeah, so we have a regular contact with naturekonservation@chg.gov.ie. I'm sure it'll be up on your website.
We'll make sure,
if people can contact that email address, and if they have photographs to send in, that'd be ideal. And that'll be passed on to the local ranger, who will contact each individual then and follow up where
possible.
But
if there's a vaccine for your pet rabbit from your vet, can you guys not find some delivery method to put it into the wild hare population and vaccinate them?
So, again, I'm not a vaccine expert, and there's all sorts of legislation.
But has that even been discussed? I mean, RHD2 has arrived, we've now established it's in the rabbit population. We've established also that it's in some hare populations. You sit around the table like we're sitting around now with your people, and you sit down and say, what are we going to do about this? And what has anybody said?
Yeah, so we have discussed.
Back to Richard's question about the prescription, but what do you do?
Absolutely, we have discussed that. I mean, the issue is that the vaccine has never been tested in wild rabbits. Has never been tested in hares, so we don't know whether it's effective or not. So if we were going to go down that route, we'd have to organise a series of clinical trials.
Yeah.
Which might be an option. It might be an option. But I think just thinking about it logistically, we have a population of somewhere around 250,000 hares. If the real host is rabbits, we have something in the order of several million rabbits. I mean, you start thinking about the vaccination.
But as you said, your report on the National Hare Survey is about to come out.
Yep.
So at least you know where they are. You have some idea where they are. So
I think you can start with the hares. Hares are everywhere. You know, hares are very widespread. We're lucky that they are very widespread.
It's an impossible task almost, isn't it?
It is an impossible task, yeah. I think it is. So I think, again, the thing about viruses, of course, is that they change so quickly that by the time you'd have something up and running, you'd
be
almost...
be number 3 or 4, yeah.
Yeah.
It's scary, isn't it, really?
How
have we survived so long? Really, when you think about it.
Well, we haven't. Half the population of Europe died with the Black Death.
And then
the
flu at the end
of
the... Was it the First World War or the Second World War?
First World War. More people died in that than died in the war, in fact. But there's always immunity to these viruses, and this is why the whole population didn't die. Yeah. So there'll be some immunity. But the trouble is with hares and rabbits, particularly with hares, if the few that survive mightn't be enough to keep the population going, given all the pressure that's on these animals in the wild anyway, from land use and from hunting and from pressure from other species and pressure from ourselves. Yeah. If enough of them don't survive, they might go over the cliff.
Yeah, that's the risk. I mean, and one of the advantages of the hare compared to the rabbit is that it's very dispersed, so you don't get them in large concentrations, whereas obviously if it comes into a rabbit colony, effectively the whole colony is at risk. You know, so
they're all doing burrows, coughing,
and they're sharing it between each other and all that sort of stuff.
I'm sure the vaccine will come. If you've developed it for rabbits, in pet rabbits, it's only a matter of time before you'll be able to try it out, or a variant of it.
He said there will have to be clinical trials, Richard.
Of course there will, yes, but don't want the bloody population going out their door.
The only comparator I can think of would be what's happened with the badger TB vaccination, which has taken maybe 10 years to develop. That was done through clinical trials.
It's on the go now, yeah.
Well, it's now ready to roll out, that was done very methodically, you know, step by step.
And yeah, but they weren't in whale bosh at the time. I mean, these lot are in whale bosh because they have this RHD2 killing them as we speak. Whereas the badgers weren't dropping dead with something as we were waiting for the vaccine.
Anyway,
there's more pressure on the
guys, Ferdia, stay with us if you would. And again, you can find the details of how to contact the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Do not send carcasses in the post under any circumstances. Do not send bits and pieces of aforementioned animals, just photographs is ideally what you're looking for. I'm sure you can send them electronically. Jarlath will make sure that they're on the website, that address, so you can visit our website, rte.ie/Munifer. You stay there, you'll know our next guest. It's 20 years since Ona Mahony captured the stunning sight of three humpback whales on film while working on a supply ship on the Kinsale gas field off the coast of County Cork.
It was just kind of like a normal routine day. We were just sitting between the two platforms, drifting. We had no propulsion system running at the time, so the vessel was very quiet. I was off watch, and I suppose it was mid-morning, and I got a call from the captain, come up to the bridge immediately. Well, we have three whales on just approaching the gas field from the west, so we were seeing an awful lot of bottlenose dolphins and common dolphins at the time, so I said it was worth recording, you know. So I ran up to the bridge and I grabbed the camcorder. It was charging at the time, so it was all good to go. So I started filming straight away, and to our amazement, they approached the vessel and came to the point where they were actually nearly touching the sides of the vessel, port and starboard side, with their pectoral fins, which was amazing. They circled the vessel for, I'd say, the best part of a good hour, you know. None of us had any experience, or we'd never seen anything like that before, you know. And it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get to see these amazing creatures up close, you know. It was like a cameraman with David Attenborough. It was amazing to film these creatures up close. They came so close at one stage. One of the three humpback whales, he nearly put his head on the stern rotor, which is at the back of the ship. He was having a spy hop, having a look around to see what was there. And there was three or four guys standing right by the stern. So in the footage, you can see that they were extremely close, which is fascinating. And the spray, it sometimes with the whales exhaling, you could get the kind of that funny boiled broccoli smell from their breaths every time they came close. And the camera was getting sprayed as well. I had to clean the lens several times. But it was an amazing day,
I'll never forget that description. Boiled broccoli smell. What a beautiful description. Well, news of the footage reached the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and identifiable details of individual whales were clear enough to form the first entries of the organisation's catalogue of sightings. The animals were named number one, number two, and number three. And, skip forward 20 years, well, almost 20 years to the day since the original sighting, number one and number two have been spotted again, still swimming together in the same neck of the woods. Simon Barrow is chief officer and CEO of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and he's also a lecturer at GMIT, and he joins us now from the Galway studio. Simon, this is great news, is it not?
It is. It's a brilliant story. I think Owen's backstory on how he got those first video footage is brilliant as well. And I think it's what the Whale and Dolphin Group is all about. You know, we as scientists like to collect the records, the data, but then we can package those piece information into a story. And when the story is told as eloquently as Owen, and the story spans 20 years, it just makes us realise how amazing the natural world is, I suppose.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, again, that's what I am. Why number one, number two, and number three? Why do you do that? Why don't you give them names, for example?
Names are useful to remember things, and we have got some with names. We had a humpback that was first seen off Hookhead breaching, and I think it was being filmed across the lines at the time. So that's known as Hookie. Just so that we know who we're talking about. But I suppose I like numbers. Number three, actually, with the third one that Owen filmed, we didn't get a fluke picture of it, so that was never identified. And number three is called Boomerang. It's the first one that the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group photographed in 2001, because it was 2 years later before Owen heard that we were interested and offered up the video. So number three is Boomerang, because it keeps coming back every year since we've recorded Boomerang in inshore Irish waters.
But you don't know if that's the number three that Owen filmed, because you didn't see his tail, or do you?
No, we don't, no.
Yeah, so it's your number three, in
it
fact.
It is,
yeah,
and ironically, number three had been seen the week before. We saw number one and number two off Kerry this year, so how amazing is that?
Simon, what inferences do you draw from finding one and two together after all these years? Why would this happen? I mean, is it just a statistical accident? They both happen to come here every year and happen to be together when you were around? Or is there something deeper? Could there be some kind of strange relationship between large whales? After all, they are polygamous. Monogamy wouldn't make any sense in these creatures, so we think. What could they be doing together?
Yeah, it's a good question, Richard. And I think we have a very simple view of things. We as people like to learn something, put it in a box and say, that's that. And of course, the more you dig deep into these relationships, the social networks, the more complex it becomes. So we're a feeding ground for humpback whales, and the breeding grounds are in the tropics. This year we had a first success in finding at least one breeding ground for Irish humpbacks in Cape Verde. So that's good. So it's a feeding ground. So why would whales associate on a feeding ground? I looked a bit of the literature since this finding, and it says that males will associate with females on the feeding grounds within a season, and they increases their chances of breeding on the breeding grounds. So maybe they try and hook up with a female on the feeding grounds like Ireland, and then follow her, stay with her all the way down to the breeding grounds, and therefore have a better chance of mating. So that makes sense.
So it's like taking her out to dinner and then having...
Yeah, long courtship.
success afterwards, yeah.
Now, number one is a male. We biopsied number one, I think, maybe 10, 15 years ago. So we know he's a male. We don't know number two. Number three is Boomerang, and he's a male as well. We also biopsied him. So assuming number two is, say, a female... It is really unusual for a male and a female to associate across seasons. So maybe it's a coincidence that he just happened to find a female and he just happened to be number two 20 years later. Or, as we suspect, there's probably something stronger going on there in terms of an association. And another layer of interest is if you look at the relationship between the whales together on the feeding grounds like Ireland, females are more likely to associate with other females that share the same genetic material, so are related in some sense. But males don't. So if number one and number two were females, you might say, well, somewhere back in the way, they must share some kind of genetic material. They are related in some way. So we don't know. It'd be nice to find out if number two is a male or a female. So as I said, it just gets more complicated. It gets more detailed. It gets more interesting. And I suppose the personalities and the intricacies of the social relationship between these large whales emerge. So, yeah, it's fantastic. And I suppose... You know, it's 20 years. Can you imagine me going to Ferdia and saying, Ferdia, I've got a 20-year research plan, with the Wireless Service fund it? They're not going to do that, and I don't blame them, and I wouldn't expect them to. So through citizen science, through empowering the likes of Owen, for letting Owen know that if you send your data to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, we will take good care of it, and we will share it, and we'll add data from other people from all around Ireland, and we can start building up these amazing stories, which span a 20-year history. So... yeah, I think it's a fantastic story, and it just makes us, I suppose, have more respect and impression of humpbacks and other whales and dolphins in Ireland.
Simon, we did have a three-year study recently which we were involved in together, the Observe programme, and what amazed me about that was just the diversity of the big whales in particular that were moving up and down off our shores on an annual basis. This is obviously another part of that equation, but do you want to give us a quick summary of what we found out from the Observe project?
Yeah, it was the Observe that I led was the acoustic side of it, and UCC led the aerial survey. So we were putting in sound recorders in deep water, 2,000 metres off the shelf edge. It's very quiet at 2,000 metres, so the detection range for whale sound. Large whales vocalise at a very low frequency, and low frequencies travel a long way. So we reckon we could detect things like blue whales and fin whales up to maybe 200 kilometres away, because the sound travels well, and we had very quiet environment that we put the recorders in. Fin whales were recorded throughout the year, especially in the winter, especially in the autumn. There was less detections in the summer, but that we associated with them not being vocal. If you're not vocalising, we can't detect you acoustically. So they're probably there in as abundance in the summer, but we just didn't detect them.
Can you tell an individual whale by its sound, or can you just tell what species it is?
Yeah, you can't. You can track individual whales if you have a series of recorders, and the time of arrival of that sound means you can actually translocate to where the animal is. It's difficult, but it can be done. We actually have a PhD student who's looking a little bit more into that at the minute in GMIT.
So you could actually get the sound of number one and number two if you were lucky.
It changes all the time. I mean, these are, as Ferdia said, we had blue whales and fin whales. Blue blue whales are actually quite abundant. Well, they're quite vocal off the west coast in the autumn and winter. Humpback whales we didn't detect very much, but the progeny didn't run through the winter when humpbacks are probably migrating along this migratory pathway, which the shelf edge is, from feeding grounds to the north, the Arctic, to probably the Caribbean. I think that the humpbacks we get in inshore waters are probably a different population and behave quite differently. But it's interesting, Aina, that humpback whale song, which I think we have some of, is it changes all the time. So it's not like I have my unique accent, or my voice, you might recognise my voice. My voice would be changing all the time. So if you talk to me in 2 years' time, I'd sound very different if I was a humpback whale singing. So it's not very good for that, but certainly you can recognise species but not necessarily individuals.
So the other whales then, the blue whales and the fin whales, you were saying they don't always make sounds. So do they make sounds when they're looking for mates? Do they make sounds when they're communicating there's food to be had? Why would they go by making noise at one time and go by not making noise at another time?
Well, if you think about humpback whales, they're probably the most studied large whale on the planet. We know more about them than anything else, and you recall Roger Payne's Song of the Humpback Whale, which was recorded and made into record in the 70s. And yet, we still don't really understand the function of whale song in things like humpback whales. So we're only really guessing what the function is for the larger whales. Obviously, they need to communicate with each other. Obviously, they need to navigate. So they probably use sound for all those functions.
Simon, whale singing is probably putting out its CV, in a sense. It's proclaiming, it's sending out information about itself and listening out for information about others out there. Now, if you're in the mating business, you will be very anxious to get a good version of your CV out, and you will be very anxious to assess the CVs of possible partners. This might be a curious explanation for why two very old whales come together. I remember with swans, when they became widowed and they repaired, the older swans repaired with older widows and widowers. They didn't go for nice young swans down the way that you would expect them to do. Now, I couldn't actually prove this because statistically I didn't get big enough samples to actually stand up, but I am certain in my own mind that if an old swan dies, it looks for an oldie as a next partner. Now, could that be hard? You see the CVs go out, the two whales, he might go for the one that's old and experienced, that has survived for 20 years and therefore has the genes for survival. She's a good bet or he's a good bet, and this might bring them together. This is a fantasy theory, but is it possible something that's going on?
It is. You know, I've read a few reviews about the function of whale song, and the classic is that they're males singing and attracting mates, and that it's like a lek in a bird's. So you have all these whales singing, and the females make a choice based on the song on who they're going to mate with. Is it the duration of the song? I can sing for 30 minutes, therefore I'm a big, strong, powerful whale. I am fit. I am good to mate with. We'll have strong offspring. Is it the complexity of the song? Is the more detail in the song impress the females, and she makes the choice? So it's a nice theory, and it stands up, and you think that's fantastic. But when you test that theory in the field and you see, well, if you've got a singing male, who checks out the male? You would expect that there'll be females checking out the male that's singing and saying, yeah, I fancy you, I love your song, let's go and make some babies. But most of the whales that actually check a singing whale out are actually other males. So I love the idea. What I like about science is you have an idea, have a hypothesis, you test it, and you realise actually all your preconceived ideas are completely wrong and something else is going on. So you rethink it and come out with another one. So it could possibly be that.
Do only males sing? Do the females not sing?
Males predominantly sing, but I was trying to dig out a study for this programme where I recall females singing too, but I couldn't actually find it at short notice. So I think there is some records of females singing. Remember, whales are supposed to sing on the breeding grounds as a lek, but actually we now know they feed in the feeding grounds. So one of the reasons we were out and photographed number one, number two, we were actually going out off West Kerry to deploy a sound trap, a recording device, to see if we could record humpback whales singing in Ireland. And we bumped into the humpbacks while we were out doing that. So it would be lovely to record more whales singing in Ireland, and in theory they would have a northeast Atlantic, maybe Irish song that they sing as well. So that was our ambition, to try and record humpback whale singing.
Simon, I always thought it'd be useful to get the bat researchers and whale researchers together. They're two groups of animals that rely for a surprising amount of their communication on sound, and in terms of the research that's going on, the bat ecologists are trying to work out what the calls mean. Bats clearly have social calls as well as their feeding buzzes. And I think there's probably a lot to learn from sitting down and discussing not just the analysis of the sound files, but also just things like the practicalities of microphones and how you actually record this information, how you analyse the WAV files that come out the other end. Maybe the All-Ireland Mammal Symposium at the end of November might be an opportunity to sit down together.
Yeah, look, and I think they do, Ferdy. I think, as you said, a lot of the software that marine people use are generally borrowed and stolen from land. So a lot of the software is made by bird researchers looking at birdsong and terrestrial mammals as well. So I think there is a good overlap in the software. Maybe the hardware is a little bit more difficult, trying to make things soundproof for the marine. But then sound travels better at sea. So I think recording sounds actually is more straightforward. And one of the things I was very pleased with on our Observe program you mentioned, the Observe Acoustic, is the logistics of going off the west coast of Ireland, dropping down and recording 2,000 metres of water, 2 kilometres of water depth on a specific spot, going back three months later and popping it up and recovering and downloading the data. To actually physically do that in a challenging environment, that's what impressed me as the PI. I just wanted to get the data and then the clever people can analyse the data. So I think those challenges can be, we can do it and it is easier at sea. But certainly, I must admit, I don't know what the bat people are doing in terms of primary research in Ireland. So it would be a fantastic opportunity to find out and share our experiences.
That's real Dr. Doolittle stuff. What about the fin whale, which appeared in the River Liffey a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, it was a sad story. I think it was always doomed to be a sad one. We actually got a report of a whale blowing off Sutton in North Dublin the day before on the Tuesday. And one of our directors, Connell, lives in Santra, and he went out and he didn't see the whale, but he talked to people on the beach. And we thought, well, it's probably a minke whale, which is common in the Irish Sea, but it sounded a bit strange. Then when this whale appeared in the Liffey the following day, the chances are it was the same one. So I suppose we knew at that stage this whale had come down the coast and gone into the Liffey. It did take us a while to actually positively identify it. It's not always that easy. We were only looking at kind of old, not so good video taken on people's smartphones. And eventually we got a video of the white right lower jaw, which is a diagnostic feature of fin whales. And it's important for us to know what species we're talking about. Because if it was a minke whale, well, they're common in the Irish Sea, so it's in the wrong place, if you like, Dublin Port, but it's not outside of its normal habitat. Mm-hmm. When we realised it was a fin whale and had been seen the day before close to shore, that's not what fin whales do. I mean, there are fin whales in the Irish Sea, but they're not that abundant, and certainly they're not close to shore. So the prognosis was never going to be very good. It was an unusual behaviour in an unusual place, and swimming into Dublin Port on the Liffey is not normal for fin whales. So
this is the second largest animal on the planet, next to the blue whale.
Isn't it unbelievable, Derek, to think that the second biggest animal on the planet swims into your capital city? And it's a pity in some ways it didn't survive for longer to give people better opportunity to see it, because it's a phenomenal opportunity. I suppose our concerns were that it had to be disorientated, it had to be sick, it had to be in not good condition, and we didn't want to add that to its stress. So,
but you don't know. I remember years ago you were carrying out, is it a post-mortem, is that what you call them?
Yep.
On the white-sided dolphins?
Yeah, yeah.
On the West Coast, must be 20-something years ago.
1994 it was, yeah.
That's your memory. But have you done that with this fin whale, or was it just buried in the ground and that was it? Did anybody have a look at it to see, was it plastic in its gut? What could be the reason?
Yeah, logistically it is very difficult. I mean, it was sad that it was found dead the following day. We're not exactly too sure. It did have collision wounds on it, and we're not sure if it got hit by a ship pre or post-mortem. Obviously, Dublin Port is a very, very busy area, so it would have been nice to know that and get more data.
But a post-mortem wasn't carried out, was it?
No, and I think...
Well, it's buried in Dollyman Strand. Presumably they could dig it up for you.
Yeah, it's not something like with a dolphin. You can, you know, we have a three-year project part funded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service to recover dolphins and porpoises for post-mortem, and that's in a very controlled environment. We take them to a regional lab in Cork, and we do it with, you know, professional vets, so of the Department of Ag. A large whale is just logistically more difficult. It's possible, it can be done. I think you need to have your structures in place before it happens. Now, this is not an unusual thing. We get large whales stranded, both alive and dead, every year, and it probably in increasing numbers, because certainly humpback whales are increasing in number of their population, and possibly fin whales as well. So I think this will happen more and more again. So I think we should have a structure in place that we can respond. It's interesting that in England, the humpback whale swam in the Thames almost the same day, which is ironic. That died. That was recovered for post-mortem. It did look like the ship had hit it before it died, because the marks are on the top of it, not the bottom of it, and they're doing a full post-mortem. So I think it is a waste opportunity, but I don't think it's something you can say, right, there's a whale, let's do it tomorrow, because you have to get track vehicles, you have to get JCBs, you have to think of disposal of carcasses, safety of people, veterinary pathologists, sampling gear. So it's something that we as...
And I know it's going to be a very smelly job because it would be decomposing at this stage, but nonetheless, you would think that, well, the only way to find out what killed it is to actually do a post-mortem, analyze toxicology and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we've taken samples of toxicology, we've taken samples of the genetics, but we could have taken more from the whale. I mean, we did a partial post-mortem on a sperm whale in Sligo in April, helped by Sligo County Council, who provided JCBs. We had 2 or 3 hours before the tide came in to get as much as we could. But we did a bit, and I think it's something we should aspire to do as a state, because it is a waste opportunity. There was quite a lot of criticism on social media that we didn't do something about it, but I don't think people understand the logistics of cutting up,
By the way, Simon, I'm not criticising at all. On the contrary.
No, but I'm just saying it's something we should aspire to do as a state, because it would be a good thing.
Well, considering that we were the first designated whale and dolphin sanctuary, the waters off the coast of Ireland, is that not true? 12 miles or something like that?
It is 200
Simon,
miles, yeah.
Simon, just to...
200 miles, is it?
He's said, yeah, 200 miles.
200 miles, excuse me.
And just to follow up on what Simon was saying there, the logistics of carrying out a post-mortem obviously are enormous, particularly on a large animal. We've even found, to come back to the rabbits and hares, that unless you actually get the animals really, really fresh, literally like within a few hours, then what you found is that internally the proteins start to break down and your ability to really diagnose what's happened becomes very, very compromised. And invariably, even though we're working very well with this particular project with the Marine Institute and with Simon's team to look at postmortems, they have to be very selective about what animals they take in, because they really need really fresh animals, because otherwise you're just going to end up with inconclusive results. And it's a lot of resources that you put into that, and unfortunately you very, very seldom can actually draw a very firm conclusion from a post-mortem.
Establishing cause of death is very difficult, even, as I said, a fresh animal in a controlled environment. But there's still samples you can get. You could look in the stomach. Plastic won't be deteriorating. So there's a spectrum of things you can get depending on the freshness of it. I agree with you, Ferdia.
Simon, thank you very much. Sorry, Richard, you want to ask one last question?
You mentioned plastic there, Simon. Suppose whales would encounter things like barrel jellyfish. The great baleen is open and you get this huge object stuck in it. It must have a mechanism for expelling such items from the mouth. When a piece of plastic comes in, a large piece of plastic, what does it do? Can it cope? Or does it swallow it back thinking it's just a nice soft jellyfish?
I wonder how they avoid jellyfish. I've been watching basking sharks feeding and they seem to avoid jellyfish as well, which is impressive. I don't know. I mean, some plastic does pass through the gut. And we have done a lot of work on plastics. We did over 500 post-mortems since the early 90s and 8.5% of the animals we looked at had large plastic in their intestines or stomach, but never was it a cause of death. So they are ingesting this stuff. Some of it gets lodged and may lead to all sorts of blockages, but a lot of it, I think, actually passes through the system as well. So I don't think plastics is a big issue in terms of whales and dolphins. It's a big issue with regarding other things, and it's a disgrace in the marine environment, but it's not a significant cause of death. So even
that
if it Bergen had plastic
whale, the Cuvier's beaked whale,
for sure,
that plastic definitely killed that.
Definitely, yeah, and it does kill some without a doubt. You see sperm whales emaciated, washed up in the med. I would be very surprised if this fin whale had plastic in its stomach, or certainly any amount that would cause its death. So yeah, it is an issue for some, but it's not in terms of, like, Ferdia works for a conservation organisation. You have to have limited resources. You put it to what is the best on the bigger picture. An individual whale dying of plastic impaction of its gut is unfortunate for the whale, but is that an effect at the population level? Probably not. Are you going to use your resources to investigate that? It's probably not a good use of limited resources.
No, but you need to know, because it does reflect how we're impacting on the oceans.
Oh, totally.
And that's why it's important to know these kind of
and
things.
So we can media be, attention. I
absolutely,
agree totally,
and it makes us more aware of how delicate the environment is. Anyway, Simon Barrow, Chief Science Officer and CEO of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group and lecturer at GMIT. Thank you very much indeed, Simon. And also to Ferdia Marnell, who's Head of Animal Ecology at the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And we'll put a link to the National Parks and Wildlife Service contact details on our website, which is rte.ie/money. Guys, Ferdia, thank you very much indeed. Now, that's the sound of the black-headed gull. We continue our mini-series in which Mooney Goes Wild reporter and biologist Terry Flanagan highlights some of the wide-ranging research currently being carried out here in Ireland. Every new generation of researchers stands on the shoulders of giants, using the understanding gained by major thinkers from the past to learn more
about the natural world and build our body of knowledge into the future. So far in the series, we've concentrated on researchers who've studied a topic with the aim of achieving an academic reward, a master's degree or maybe a PhD. Today, we feature something a little different, as we're following a research project that won't lead to a formal qualification. Brian Burke works full-time with Birdwatch Ireland, but for the last few years, he spent his holidays on Loch Ree, where in conjunction with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, he's managed to trap and ring hundreds of black-headed and lesser black-backed gulls. He's done this out of personal interest and to learn more about their lifestyle and particularly their movements.
Their terns, I think, Brian, it's not what we're listening to.
Yeah, so you can hear the terns there just flying over and back over the sea, and just below them then there's a good big flock of oyster catchers as well.
I can see them there. They're on the ground. There must be, what, a couple of hundred of them?
Yeah, I'd say 600-700 at least, yeah.
But we haven't come to see either of those tonight. We've come to see the gulls.
Yeah, so just here in front of us actually there's a couple of hundred gulls just roosting, so just kind of sitting on the sand and just resting.
And you've been studying these now for the summer?
Yeah, so this year with the National Parks and Wildlife Service in Roscommon and Longford, we went out and we ringed 300 chicks of black-headed gulls on Loch Ree. So we want to kind of get an idea of where they're going and what they get up to.
Now, you're not doing this as part of a project or a thesis, a master's or anything like that?
No, so my day job is with Birdwatch Ireland, and during the summer I take a couple of days off and I go and I ring some birds.
Now, why are you doing that?
Just out of kind of personal interest and an appreciation, I suppose, of Loch Ree, the fantastic gull colonies that are there, and just wanting to learn more about them.
And you've done this last year as well, am I right?
Yeah, so last year we started off with a lesser black-back gull ringing project. So myself, the rangers and a few other interested people around Loch Ree, we ringed 300 lesser black-back gull chicks. Mm-hmm. And then this year, as well as doing the lesser black-back gulls, we took on a black-headed gull ringing project as well.
And it's the black-headed gulls we're looking at here now, except that as I look at them through the scope, they're not really black.
No, so if you look at them from a distance, they definitely look like they have a black head. But actually, depending on what time of the year you're looking at them, they'll either have a brown head or a white head. So their breeding plumage, they have this lovely chocolatey brown head. They lose that in kind of the autumn, and then in the winter it's this white head.
Now, I've just seen some of them here, some of the black-headed gulls, and you have them ringed, and I can see the rings on them. Explain the rings.
So the ring, it's a small plastic ring, and the idea is that it can be read from a distance. So it's got a four-number code on it. So if you're out here with your binoculars, with a camera or with a telescope, and you see a gull with that four-letter or four-number code, and you read the colour, you see the colour of the ring as well, and you can look them up online, and essentially you'll find my contact details or the contact details of whoever rings that bird that you're looking at. You can get in touch with them, and you can tell them where you saw that bird.
So even though you ringed a lot of birds in County Roscommon, we're here tonight in Sandymount Beach. And
yeah.
You're seeing the same birds.
Yeah, that's the thing. So one of the reasons myself and MPWS wanted to do this project is essentially to see where these birds go. So these birds all hatched on Loch Ree this summer in June. Took a couple of weeks to fledge, and then it's kind of where do they go after that. So we know from other ringing projects that suggest, you know, they might move further south, maybe over to the west coast, to Galway or to somewhere like Limerick. Actually, the first two birds that have been seen from our project have been on a beach in County Meath, and I happened to see one on Bull Island 2 weeks ago in Dublin.
That must give you great pleasure to see it again, because I'm sure the chances of you seeing a bird, let's say you've ringed 300 birds in a summer, what are the chances of you seeing even one of those birds next year, the year after?
So with a gull that lives quite a long time, it could be a good chance, but it depends on where you go and where that bird goes. But it's really satisfying to spot a bird with a colour ring on it, to read that ring, and, you know, to get the information back. But it's even more satisfying when it's one of your birds that you were literally holding in your hand a couple of weeks before.
And will they migrate in the autumn time? Will they travel abroad?
Some of them will go abroad. Some of them will just go to different parts of Ireland. Some of them might even stay on Loch Ree, and they're the kind of questions we want to answer. The lesser black-back gulls, which we were ringing last year as well as this year, they are our only species of gull that's truly migratory. So we've had birds that we ringed on that little island kind of in the middle of Loch Ree, kind of Longford-Roscommon border. And those birds have turned up in England, in Spain, in Portugal, in Morocco, in Senegal, and even in the Gambia.
Did you expect that, or did you know that?
So a lot of these studies have been done in other countries. They've been done in the UK. We have much fewer ringers in Ireland. So these kind of projects haven't been replicated in Ireland. So we can't assume, essentially, that what's true in the UK, what these birds do when, you know, they're in the UK, is the same as what they do in Ireland. So that's what we're trying to figure out. Is it the same? Is it slightly different? And, you know, where are those differences?
Now, as I say, we're here in Sandymount Beach. The tide is out. It's probably half a kilometre or so there before we can actually get to the sea. There's a lot of traffic behind us. There's air traffic above us. Yet, when you look through the scope, all of these birds, all of the flocks, they look very relaxed. They must be quite used to it.
This part of Dublin Bay especially is a really fantastic site, just the sheer size of it. There's loads of space, and essentially those birds know, because they're out in the middle of the sand there, that if there's a predator coming, they'll see it coming. So with that in mind, they can get habituated to the noise of planes, the noise of people playing volleyball here in the background, of people walking up and down. They get used to it.
I must say, the black-headed gulls, they're a really, really pretty bird.
Yeah, I think they're one that people really underestimate. So actually, during both the summer and the winter, they're our most common gull species. You get them inland, you get them along the coast, and a lot of people are probably walking by them, you know, every day of the year and not even realising it, or taking the time to maybe stop and look at them and realise the journey that these birds might have undertaken.
OK, I'm just going to have a look through the scope here, because as I look through it, I can see that they look as if they're feeding, are they?
Some of them are feeding. They're kind of pattering around in the as the water comes in there, and they're going for some of the invertebrates that are coming up through the sand. The majority of them, though, are just resting, so they would have been feeding during the day. Some of them probably spent the day in some of the parks maybe around Dublin, and they come here as a safe space to roost, to rest. So they've got the safety in numbers here all together, and again, they're in a spot where if a predator comes, they'll see it coming.
And do you come here at a particular time as regards the tide? Because the tide is coming in now. It's actually coming in pretty fast. We can see it here behind us.
Yeah, so it kind of depends on the site. Some sites you want to go to at low tide because maybe the rocks or the bit of beach is exposed and the birds have somewhere to rest. For Sandyman Strand and South Dublin Bay in particular, you want to come on a rising tide or a high tide, because if you don't, there's essentially, you know, it's 2 kilometres by 4 or 5 kilometres nearly in size. So there's a huge amount of area that the birds can be spread out amongst. You know, you want them kind of pushed up a bit closer together and within reach. So yeah, a rising tide or a high tide pushes them up a bit closer to you.
Now, the tide will probably come in here, what, in the next 2 hours or so. What will the birds do then?
Some of them, they'll decide to stay on dry land. So essentially, there'll be little kind of islands nearly in the bay, and they'll just stand on them. A lot of them will be just as happy to sit on the water and just wait until the tide goes out a little bit again.
Okay, so from your ringing in the last year or two, tell us, what have you learned?
I suppose the Black-Headed Gull project has only started this year. Already we're surprised that the first two birds we had didn't go west. They didn't follow the Shannon to the coast. They came over to the east coast. So that's a nice start to the project for sure. And with the lesser black-back gulls, it's been really, really interesting to see the journeys that they've undertaken. And actually, there's another lesser black-back gull ringing project that started last year on Cape Clear. So we have this inland project, which is our project on Lough Ree, and we've a coastal one in Cape Clear in County Cork. So it's been interesting to see the commonalities and the differences between those two ringing projects. They're the same species, they're both in Ireland but in very different habitats, and just seeing the kind of what's the same and what's different.
You mentioned commonality there. How common is it for guys like you to go out and do research like this? Because I presume you're going to have to get a license, then you have to devise a project, you have to work in, I presume, with the likes of the National Parks and Wildlife Service or Birdwatch Ireland. There's a lot of time, a lot of effort goes into it. Are there many people doing this?
No, so there are a lot of trained and licensed ringers in the UK. In Ireland, there's very few. There's probably 100 or less. And if you whittle that down to the ones that are quite active and maybe the ones that are interested in gulls rather than waders or passerines and garden birds, it's fewer again. So there's very few of us in Ireland. We're kind of lacking a lot of the data for Irish birds that they have for the same birds in the UK. So there is a bit of work involved, but it's really, really rewarding, and it's, you know, you feel like you're making a contribution to the conservation of these birds in Ireland.
And where would you hope to take these two projects?
Gulls live for quite a long time, so black-headed gulls will come back and breed when they're 2 or 3 years old. The lesser black-back gulls will be kind of 4 or 5 before they come back to breed. I hope to continue these projects with other ringers and with the National Parks and Wildlife Service for many years into the future. The longer the project goes on, the more questions that are relevant to their conservation that we'll be able to answer.
Well, will the first couple of years, the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years be somewhat frustrating because you won't see these birds? They will have left and they won't come back to actually breed.
Yeah, but that's kind of interesting too. So the lesser black-back gulls, again, which undertake that long-distance migration, I actually got emails today from 2 different people in 2 parts of Portugal to say birds that I ringed last June 2018, were kind of hanging around in Portugal now at the moment. So it's interesting to see what they do. But yeah, I'm absolutely really looking forward to seeing them back on Lough Ree in the breeding colony and to see, you know, to see them kind of.
Yeah, but you
forward.
Don't actually have to see them back because, as you say, you're getting results from Portugal. So you know what's actually happening to the birds, even though they're not breeding.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's the beauty of colour ringing, and, you know, it's not expensive like a lot of the high-level tracking technology. It's, you know, it's quite simplistic, really. It's bird has this little bit of plastic on its leg. It's just like wearing a watch for the bird. They don't even notice it. But that's someone in Portugal, someone in Morocco or even the Gambia, you know, is looking out through their telescope and seeing that bird that we ringed, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of months previously. It's really fascinating. And the strength of these projects, you know, it's only as good as the ringers and the ring readers who are out there, you know, the people in all those countries and all the different parts of Ireland who are taking their evenings to go out and look for these ringed birds. We're very grateful to them.
And of course it works in reverse too, because you're here and you're looking and they say, oh, there's a bird, I didn't ring that bird, but I'll take a note of it and I'll get to see who does own that bird, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm here kind of selfishly looking for my own black-headed gulls. I have seen black-headed gulls from Norway, from Poland. I've seen some med gulls that I think are from Belgium. I'm going to have to look them up. And as well as that, there's the oyster catchers we mentioned earlier. So I've got read a good few rings that are part of our Birdwatch Ireland's Dublin Bay Birds project.
So in total tonight, how many ring birds have you seen?
I think I've seen around 20, and there's still a little bit of daylight left, so I might get a few yet.
That's an incredible number. I didn't think you'd get anywhere near that.
This is a really good time, so all these birds are finished breeding. And, you know, a lot of them hang out on these beaches, you know, for a couple of weeks. Some of them will move further on, some of them will stay in Dublin for the winter. But yeah, this is a really good time for ring reading.
So I presume they're just here fattening up, getting ready to head off.
Yeah, that's essentially it. They're not tied to the breeding colony and they're thinking of maybe migrating or setting up shop somewhere for the winter. So they're feeding up, they're resting and got to think about their next move.
And as we finish off, I see the tide is coming closer and closer to us. So I suppose we're going to have to move, but you're going to continue on spotting some birds, yeah?
Yeah, a little bit of daylight left, so I'm going to make the best of it, absolutely.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. And for more information on this story or anything else you heard on today's programme, visit the website rte.ie/money. That's all we have time for. My thanks to all of our contributors today, Aileen Ilana, Richard Collins, Ferdy Marnell and Simon Barrow, to our researcher John Riley, our producer Anna Leddy, and on sound we had Jamie Doyle. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.